Earlier you said that there are some people who know you well. Why do I get the feeling that that is not true?
Mr. Gray, your next meeting is in the conference room.
Cancel, please. We're not finished here.
Yes, sir.
No, I can go. It's fine.
I would like to know more about you.
There's really not much to know about me.
You said you're an English major? Tell me, was it Charlotte Bronte, Jane Austen, or Thomas Hardy who first made you fall in love with literature?
Hardy.
I would have guessed Jane Austen. What are your plans after you graduate?
I'm just trying to get through finals right now.
And then?
And then I was planning on moving here to Seattle with Kate.
We offer an excellent internship program.
I don't think I'd fit in here. Look at me.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm managing editor Matt Goldberg, and with me today is news editor Adam Chitwood.
Hello.
And associate editor Haley Fouch.
Hello.
Today we'll be talking about Kingsman and 50 Shades of Grey. Both films did well over the weekend. One did slightly better than the other. The one that did better was the one that came from Twilight fanfiction. I know that keeps getting hung around 50 Shades of Grey's neck, and we will talk about that more. But let's start up with a movie we liked more. Or Haley, I don't know actually what you thought of 50 Shades of Grey. I know I didn't care for it.
Nope.
Okay, so good. So we'll keep that in mind, dear listener, and we'll get to it later. But Haley, how did you feel about Kingsman?
I enjoyed Kingsman. I think my expectations maybe were a little too high because the hype was pretty intense, but I really enjoyed it. I thought it was going to be more of a vehicle for Colin, but it turned out to be more of a vehicle for Taron Egerton. Is that how you say his name? I've never said it out loud. I've just written it.
I could go with that. I keep thinking it's Edgerton, but it's probably Egerton.
It could be Edgerton, too. I'm always wrong.
I would say Egerton. Egerton sounds more British.
That's why they call him Eggsy.
Eggsy.
Right. And he was great. It's not a bad thing that it was his vehicle. I just wasn't expecting that. But no, I thought it was really fun. What about you guys?
Well, my review's on the site, so Adam, you
That's
go.
That's true.
I fucking loved it. I don't know. I was expecting it to be fun and to be good, because I've liked all of Matthew Vaughn's films thus far, but I think this is his best yet. I had a giant smile on my face from beginning to end. I thought it was over the top and crass and funny and fun and progressive in parts, in ways that I wasn't
perhaps
expecting.
Perhaps not the final shot.
Not the final joke, which was odd. But man, I just loved it. I came out of it. I mean, as if you've listened to this podcast, you know I'm not the biggest fan of Marvel movies. I enjoy them, but I came out and I was like, this must be what like people like that feel when they see those movies that they like so much, because I had a giant smile on my face. I was like, I feel so great. Yeah, man, I just loved it. I thought
you may not know this, but Adam doesn't like movies.
I don't like
movies. This is a rare experience for him to enjoy a film.
But the kind of, like, you know, the kind of, like, pure pop movies that, I mean, usually, like, nowadays they're geared towards the Marvel folks and, like, superheroes and stuff, or you get, like, Transformers. So I find myself kind of down the middle on a lot of, quote-unquote, pop movies. But this one was right up my alley. I thought Edgerton was fantastic. Announced himself as a really strong new young talent. I liked the winkiness towards the Bond, but I didn't feel like it went overkill. I thought it was its own movie and its own spy movie in a way. I mean, it acknowledges spy movies and spy tropes while also being its own thing. But yeah, I just had a blast with it.
I'm curious, just since before we leave it, how did the last joke play in your guys' theater? Or did you, I'm not sure if you saw it in a regular theater or a screening, but how did that go over for your group?
I saw it in a theater, and people laughed. It was one of those things where I like kind of like smirked, and as I was walking out, I was like, that was kind of, it's kind of weird, wasn't it? It's like a little off-putting.
It played like a fucking dead fish in my theater, like at all. Yeah, it was really interesting. Like, I got a chuckle, but it was dead silence.
Mine was sort of down the middle. I saw it at a promo screening, so press were there, but it was with a general audience, and people laughed, but I don't know, at that point, at least for me personally, I had already been kind of taken out of the movie a bit because of the church scene, which is where I feel the film turns.
Because it's
way.
Amazing.
Yeah, I agree.
Visually, it's amazing. Thematically, it's a little troubling. I think, to me, up to that point, I think the film is actually very clever and quick-witted. It's a film that's totally comfortable dishing out a My Fair Lady reference, and I love that. And I think it's, you know, quick, but it's still good action. And then that scene comes along, and to me, it's like, it's very much trying to me, it's playing to, like, just violence, but without any thinking of the larger ramifications of how that scene would play. And I find that scene, as well executed as it is, I'm sitting there, I'm wondering, like, but why would this... I just don't feel like that scene is fun. I think it sort of hits an off key, because I think what it's going for is, like, oh, these people deserve it. And my feeling is, no, they don't. But they don't. I mean, that's the thing. Like, the film sets that up. It wants you to be on its side so that when this happens, you can sit back and in the knowledge be like, well, at least, I mean, these people are getting fucking destroyed, but they're not very nice, so it's okay. And for me, it's like, that scene is horrific. That scene is actually pretty nightmarish. But, you know, you're playing like you're rocking out to Freebird. And I admit that that scene is brilliantly directed in the sense of how frenetic it is, how well edited it is. It looks great, but it plays poorly.
I disagree. I don't think that it's saying that, you know, oh, these guys are terrible, so it's okay for them to be killed. I think it's supposed to be shocking, but this is a movie where people's heads explode into, like, fountains of color. Like, it's a twisted movie, and it's a sick movie, and I think it's supposed to be sick. It's not supposed to be... I don't think that scene, to me anyway, it didn't play as, you know, it's totally okay that he's killing all these people. To me, it played like, that's fucked up, but, like, this is kind of fun.
I think, to me, it's like, it's darkly comic, and it misses the comic. Like, I see that, like, it's trying to be enjoyable, but the darkness of the scene just overwhelms any humor that could be derived from it. And then from that point on, I found that a lot of, like, the cleverness and sort of composure of the film started to go out the window, to when you have a scene with everyone's head exploding, which I love that scene, but that is so, you know, like, colored explosions. It's like we're almost in a different movie by that point that's completely divorced from anything that you would have seen in the first half. And that's fine. I mean, it's enjoyable, but the tenor of it changes to the point where it's like, this is enjoyable, but not as tight as what had come before. And I feel like the culmination of that is the final joke, which is very much feels like Mark Miller is now doing all the talking, where it's very juvenile and misogynistic. And that's something where it's like, it's to me, like, that's the film at its nadir. And it has been sort of on a downhill slide, where it's not that the film necessarily plummets after the church scene, but it's one where I started to, up to that church scene, I'm like, this is one of the best films of the year, easy, no problem. And then after the church scene, I'm like, okay, now we're sort of on uneven ground, where, you know, I'm now thinking about the villain's plan and how it's really kind of stupid and things of that nature. I've been taken out of the film to an extent.
I would agree that the tone of the film definitely changes after the church scene, and I don't think it changes necessarily for the better. I think it gets weaker in the third act. But for me, the church scene didn't play as comic. It was engaging and, like you said, very well shot. But for me, what it did was sort of establish the threat of what he's doing. Like, obviously not everyone is capable of what happens in that scene, but it does demonstrate how vicious of a plan he has.
See, to me, it's like it's in this weird... I agree that you definitely need to show what his plan is, but I think at that point you either need to do it in a way that's either, frankly, playing it safe, like, you know, he's among terrorists or something, like people like, okay, these are bad people and they're violent and they should die and they were going to die anyway, or you go so outlandish, like it happens at like a fucking daycare center or something, like it's just so ridiculous that it would even happen in this one location, that it therefore goes to the opposite extreme. The church, I think, is trying to find a middle ground, and then it just gets swallowed up in a pit of despair.
Yes, see, I didn't get that at all. I didn't get any. There was no despair from the way I was watching it. And I do agree that the tone shifts a little bit, but I think it's still in keeping. Like, this whole movie is out there. Like, Sam Jackson's got this weird lisp, and he's got Happy Meals. Like, it's a crazy. Like, his henchman has knives for the legs. Bottom halves of her legs. Like, this movie is nuts, and I love it because it's just that it's that R-rated, like, unabashed, like, I mean, this is a movie for adults, and we don't get these that much anymore because everything is so targeted towards the four quadrant demographic that everything's down the middle, and it's, you know, let's not offend people, let's not go too over the top. So while I do think that in some spots it may tend towards the offensive, and I'm thinking mainly about that last joke, which easily could have just been taken out, and I think that would have helped it not end on a sour note. I still am happy that it exists, and I'm happy that something like this is being made for audiences like this. And it's also progressive in a surprising way, in that, you know, he goes through training and everything, and there's Roxy. First of all, there's two women who are in the training, and it's not, there's no big deal of it. It's not the, you know, they're doing the training and the guys aren't like, oh, well, you girls aren't going to make it. Like, it's not like, let's point out that there are girls here. It's just like, oh, this is normal. And then after that, it's like, oh, well, I bet, you know, Roxy is his love interest. They're going to, nope. They're just like friendly, both incredibly capable, young, talented agents. That's it. And I love that. I really, really like that.
If I can just go back, though, to, I mean, I agree. I like that. I thought Roxy was a good character. And again, you know, that's part of the first half where I'm super with the movie. But when you say that it's nuts, I actually don't think that, I think the film is outlandish, but I don't think there are parts of it that seem nuts, but actually they do make sense. Like, the whole Happy Meal scene is, like, it's funny and it's a little crazy, but at the same time, it's very much pointing out one of the film's themes, which is about class conflict, you know? And it's also very much a scene that's in line with the tone that I think the first half struck very well, which is, we're going to add some sort of fistica. We're going to, you know, get a little rough around the edges of a finely tailored suit. You know, we're going to blend this high class with this, you know, middle brow feeling and see what we get. It's hamburgers with fine wine. And for the first half, I think that combination works really, really well, and I was really with it. And, you know, his henchman, Gazelle, that's totally, like, in keeping with Jaws. Like, that's just the evolution of Jaws.
Sure.
So I was... What? An Oddjob. That's totally... It's in the vein of that character. Makes total sense. Didn't have an issue with it. Thought it was fun and clever. I was with all of that. I just feel that everything that was so tight in the first half then eventually falls away. And also, I think, you know, when one of your major character, you know, I think, you know, because the film also loses one of its greatest assets in the second half as well, and I won't say any more.
And that was something I was kind of, I don't know why I was expecting it, but I went into this movie pretty sure that was going to happen. And it didn't alter my enjoyment of it, because I was kind of worried. It was like, eh, man, if I know this, then, like, is the movie going to suck? But I was fine from that end. But like you said, I did really appreciate the class aspect of it. It's a movie that's about something. It's not just fun for fun's sake. Like, it genuinely gets into that, and it paints Eggsy as this character who's trying to find the line between, you know, the high class silver spoon gentleman and you know, the kid on the street, and not in any kind of you know, like, cliched or stereotypical way. It feels very grounded emotionally, which is something that I really appreciate. I thought the whole prologue was done in a way that, you know, it tells you that this is an adult movie because it's kind of darkly comic, but it's also emotional. It doesn't shy away from being emotional about this thing that happens in the prologue, this thing that happens in the beginning. It's not just kind of shoving it off. So that there are stakes, and it doesn't feel like a cartoon where, you know, if people die, it's just whatever.
Well, I mean, but it does feel like a cartoon at some point. I mean, it's cartoonish.
I mean, it is literally a cartoon when heads are exploding into clouds of color. Yes. But I just meant in the from the emotional standpoint of it.
I'm sorry, Haley, what were you saying?
Oh, I was just going to say, I get what Adam's saying, though. It's not like a cartoon in that the stakes are real. Like, they make most lives that are relevant to the story, if they're lost, they have a cost. But before we move on completely from this, I did want to say about Roxy, like, they built her up as a really cool character, and I appreciated everything about that, but I do feel she was shortchanged in the end, like the way that, and it was sort of clever the way they did it, but she was sort of removed from the last part of the film. And I just felt like that was, after the way they had built her up, it was a little unfair to the character. Be like, you go do this and we'll handle the climax.
Yeah, she just kind of, I mean, that it didn't bother me as much as other things in the film. But I mean, it's an unenviable task. It is like someone, okay, for the stakes you have set up, someone has to do this job. I'll, of course, you know, it's a movie, write something and try to make it happen. And I agree, it would have been cool to see sort of Roxy get into the nitty gritty of it. Although, again, by that time for me, I felt the nitty gritty was becoming a little tedious. I like the, you know, in terms of the action, I had liked so much of the action before, and then the movie starts going into, like, picking up imagery from first-person shooters.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, that's a very interesting choice, because the notion is that, you know, where is this character existing at this point? Is this just the continuation of, oh, the first-person aesthetic? You know, if you take a first-person shooter aesthetic, then that sort of, to me, makes me think of... you know, Air Force or military people that go and recruit their drone pilots from being first-person shooters. Like, the first-person shooter is ingrained in the average person. So is that just part of Eggsy's life, just being a first-person shooter, and now we're seeing that come to life? Or is he now refined and Vaughn's just doing this particular shot because it looks cool? Because back in the church, the message I'm getting is because it looks cool. And so my doubts carried forward. And also, I just thought it visually wasn't as interesting to sort of look down the barrel of the gun and see people mowed down.
But I didn't think that, I mean, I might be remembering it wrong. I don't remember the first person stuff being that prevalent.
It's not prevalent, but he goes, it's not that it's a shot, it's not like Doom, where the climax of the film is shot in that particular style, but there were a lot of, there were multiple inserts where he's going from that particular angle that is very much recalls a first person shooter game.
I just didn't pick up on that. I might have, I don't know.
All right. You know, but again, like I there was just, for me, the film, again, second half thing, like, it would have been cool to see Roxy have a bigger part.
Yeah. Well, and on the Roxy thing too, it did, because I was kind of getting that feeling. I was like, are they going to, like, stick her in front of a computer for this third act and have her just, like, go left, do this? And so, like, when she does get her task or her mission, I was kind of like, all right, like, they're trying to give equal weight to the stakes that she has. Like, her part of this mission is as important, and not in as important as, like, a, you know, let's put the woman in a safe place to do it. Like, she's also risking her life. It's just not in the middle of the action. It's in the middle of a different part of the action. So I do agree that she was a little shortchanged by the end, but it wasn't as bad as I was fearing as I was watching it in real time. I was like, are you going to do that? Are we going to go here?
And they do have, you know, the ass-kicking female character, and by ass-kicking, I mean that she physically hurts people. You know, with Gazelle, you know, she's there. They use her, which is nice. I mean, again, she's a fine henchman. Samuel Jackson is amusing. It's always nice to see. Like, I was watching this, and then I was thinking, and just think, 1 year ago he was in RoboCop, not giving a shit. Like, RoboCop is him standing in a room for a couple days, and then this one is like, it's a role where, like, you know, it's a very cartoonish role, but he's having a fun time. I enjoyed.
And I love that he's an internet villain. Like the villain is an internet billionaire, and his plot is very, again, progressive. It's something you're not expecting, which I thought was interesting. It wasn't the same old that, you know, you see time and again of, you know, I don't want to bring it back to comic book movies, but it's always, I'm going to destroy the world, blah, blah, blah. It wasn't, it was more complicated.
Yeah, but his plan is still pretty dumb.
I thought it was fine. I thought it was at least interesting. And with the Bond,
his motives are interesting. I'll give him that.
Yeah, but all of the Bond villain plots are dumb. I mean, most of the Bond villain plots are dumb. And it's about getting from point A to point B. And I think the getting from point A to point B was enjoyable enough and interesting enough and funny enough and emotionally tethered enough to make it worthwhile.
I just felt like there was just, I had gotten it, like, he's a fun character, but I felt with Valentine, or, and maybe you picked up on something I didn't, but let me ask you guys, Valentine, from a class perspective, where do you think he comes from? Do you think he is Silver Spoon, or do you think he's from the streets? Because I think that's important for my reading. Like, go on.
No, he seemed very middle class, not from the streets, certainly not middle spoon, but there was nothing about him that screamed hardship. I mean, he seemed very middle class to me. Like, he was okay, and like his money or his brilliance, whatever, gave him power to maybe enact ideas that as a youth he had too much time to ponder because he wasn't working all the time. But he didn't strike me as Silver Spoon at all. What about you,
Adam? I felt the same way.
See, to me, because I wanted to have just a little bit better idea of his origins, because the people he tries to save are all upper class. Like, he makes a point. Like, he is trying to save a particular class of people. And my interest in that was, is that because they are his class, or he wants to be that class?
I think he wants to be that class.
So yeah. He was not already among... See, he wants to be that class, but... So does that mean he's already in it? Or does he envy it? Because I'm trying to look at it from the perspective of what is the lesson towards Eggsy, which is it's who you are, not where you're from.
And well, I'm just trying to see... The way I read it was that he, you know, was a man from the middle class, not born with a silver spoon. Obviously has all this money now, but wants to fit in. Wants to be, you know, grew up watching Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, all that stuff. I think it's encapsulated in the scene when he goes and gets fitted for a suit and gets a top hat, where he's kind of like, this is a nice top hat. And just kind of the wardrobe he wears and the fact that he's choosing McDonald's and everything, I feel like it was very indicative of someone wanting to fit in and just felt like it was expected. Like, when you have that much money, you are supposed to be of this upper class. It makes you a better person because you have more money.
So you think he's kind of a poser?
Yeah.
Okay. See, I just thought that was, and then I thought it was like, well, and I guess that's an interesting point. I hadn't thought of it to look at it that particular way, or rather, it helps clear up my mixed feelings on the character. Because to me, if the film wants to have this thematic through line, then Valentine can't just be a cartoon. Like, to me, like, that's where Kingsman is getting dangerously close to the line of, you are a, you know, you're a smart film. This is a smart film for a large chunk of it. And my fear with it was, and it sometimes I saw it veering into, we're going to do this because it'll get cheap thrills or easy laughs or because it looks cool. And I felt like the film teetered into that, especially in the second half.
I mean, in terms of...
Oh, go ahead.
Well, just in terms of the idea of the message to Eggsy, I think there is something to be said for, you can, you know, if you want to be a part of a certain class. And I think that because of his success, Valentine was already there. He just didn't feel there, and he wanted that exclusivity. But there's a way of getting there through ruthless means and cheating your way into it, so to speak, or you can earn your way, which I think is what Eggsy does. He earns his way to a better sort of lifestyle.
Of course, Valentine basically, I mean, he had invented it. I mean, the film makes it clear that, again, this is why I asked the question, like, he didn't inherit his wealth. You know, he did invent something. He didn't make something of it. So the fact that he's now in that upper social stratosphere, hasn't he made something of himself? Hasn't he earned his way in his own way?
That's very true. So maybe it's more a matter of feeling that you deserve it. I don't...
Perhaps.
He feels that he fits in, and so he needs to make a world where maybe he's the only one, you know, he's made that world. There's no way he can't fit in.
Well, and I think he's also, I mean, not without getting into spoilers, I think he's a believer in his plan. He's not an evil villain who has a plan just to make money. I think that he's honestly a believer in his plan, and thus the things that he's doing are to create the best outcome from that plan.
Yeah,
it's hard to talk around this, but that's the best way I can put it.
Yeah. So I think it's okay that we're talking. Like, here's the thing. Like, I could go into it, but I think Kingsman is a movie worth seeing. Even though I have issues with it and it frustrates me, because again, I was in love with this film for like the first half. I just like, this is amazing. It's so funny. It's so sharp.
And Edgerton's great.
Edgerton's great.
I can't wait to see him do other stuff too, because he seems like a really three-dimensional. Like, sometimes you get these like new up-and-comers. It's like, oh, it's gonna be the next guy, and he's just a blank face, and it's just like, this could have been anybody.
Jamie Dornan. Oh, I'm sorry. Go on. We're not there yet.
But yeah, I thought Edgerton really delivered, and the supporting cast as well. Mark Strong in a surprising role, not the role, like, I knew Mark Strong was in the cast, but it's something I wasn't expecting, but something that I really hope this turns into a franchise, because I want to see him recurring in that role, because I thought it. Yeah, I thought it was really funny. I think that's just a really smart casting choice of putting him in that character in that role.
Well, the other thing about it that could, you know. I definitely want to see more of these movies as well. That's another reason why I don't want to tell people what happens, because I think that the world has a lot of potential to it. I may have had problems with the structure and this particular aspects of this story, but like, I want to see other Kingsmen, you know?
Yeah.
I want to know more about, this is an interesting world that's being created. It has its own flavor, it has its own tone, and I don't want to just dismiss it outright. And especially if you're going to put it on the shoulders of Edgerton or whatever.
This is assuming that Matthew Vaughn signs on to direct the sequel and stays signed on to direct the sequel.
Well, even if he does, look, here's the thing. Even if he doesn't, this to me is a franchise that I think could work, unlike Kick-Ass, which is definitely a much harder needle to thread. This one feels like it's big enough to invite someone, like, I think definitely Vaughn's personality is a big part of Kingsman, but I think that what has been built for Kingsman, if you said there's going to be another Kingsman, but it's from a director who I don't hate, you know, if you're telling me, like, Robert Schwenke wants to direct Kingsman 2, then I'm like, no, thank you. But, you know, I would be open to a Kingsman that wasn't directed by Matthew Vaughn. If he wants to direct another one, great. At the same time, though, I kind of want to see Matthew Vaughn do more things.
Yeah, I just want to see.
He's a really exciting director.
Yeah, he is. But yeah, obviously the danger of another director coming in is I'll just make a riff on a Bond movie. It's just, it's not that easy. Seeing what Vaughn did, it's a very specific tone honed in on. And I haven't read the Mark Millar comic. Apparently, his comics aren't good.
They aren't. They're
and
dog
I,
shit.
Apparently, that this movie is loosely based on the comic. I guess it's supposedly very different.
Yeah, although just to quickly interject, we should also point out that Jane Goldman is a big part of all of Matthew Vaughn's success. She's his co-writer, producer, so her input to this is a big deal as well. And I think if there was another Kingsman film where Vaughn didn't return to direct, I hope that the two of them, Goldman and Vaughn, would at least have some input into the script.
Yeah,
great.
Okay, so that's a good movie. And you should see it. Now let's talk about a bad movie that a lot of people ended up seeing. And if you're worried about 50 Shades of Grey spoilers, now's the time to stop listening. But if you don't care, let's move on. 50 Shades of Grey. What'd you guys think?
Oh boy.
Hey, Haley, you go ahead.
Oh boy, we got it. There we go.
I've got a lot of feelings about 50 Shades of Grey. Not a lot of them are good. I find the whole thing very interesting as a cultural phenomenon. I've been following it for a while. I read the book when it first came out, like, whoa, why are people all of a sudden talking about BDSM? Like, it's totally normal. That's weird. And it's just upsetting in every way. I think the movie was even more upsetting than the book. Like, it's about a very, very mentally abusive relationship, and it makes it try to seem sexy. But the reason my feelings are conflicted about the movie is I almost think that the director was aware of how abusive it was, because some of the scenes were so intensely upsetting to me that I think she knew what she was doing. And because of the way the film ends, I don't see her coming back on for sequels. I just don't see that happening. But it's a mess, and that's not even dealing with the physical abuse at the end. It's just, it's an upsetting movie if you've ever been in a similar situation with a relationship that was just emotionally bad for two people to be in. And it's just not a good movie. It's not entertaining. It's a whole bunch of no fun. You guys tell me your thoughts and we'll get into more specific stuff.
Well, first, Adam, I'll get to you in just a second, but just to piggyback on to what you just said, Haley, about the abusiveness of the book, my girlfriend linked me to, so there was the poster, the real teaser poster, which is Mr. Gray Will See You Now, and so someone took that image and then put in new text that is actually from the book, and reading this text made me realize that the movie is a much, much, much softer version of the book. I'm just going to share some stuff right now. Christ, Anna, he bangs his fist on the table, making me jump, and stands so abruptly he almost knocks the dining chair over. You have to remember one thing to remember. Shit, I don't fucking believe it. How could you be so stupid? Oh, gosh, what is another one? He stops. If you struggle, I'll tie your feet too. If you make a noise, Anastasia, I will gag you. And here's a good one. Alaska is very cold and no place to run. I would find you. I can track your cell phone, remember?
Yep.
None of those lines are in the movie. So, point to the movie? Adam, what do you think about 50 Shades of Grey, the film?
I had a similar reaction as Haley did. I mean, all these people were complaining, like, the sex is too tame, you know, the sex is boring, the sex is not sexy, and so I was watching and I was like, so first of all, the sex scenes, I felt, were dangerous from an emotional standpoint. I don't think the point of them, so if he's introducing this young woman to BDSM, he's not gonna, like, just, like, whip her as hard as he can with a, you know, lashes and stuff. That makes no sense. So the, you know, the light whatever play of it felt fine to me. But what was upsetting to me and upsetting to my girlfriend as we were watching it was that this is an incredibly emotionally abusive relationship. And he is such a dick. Like, he is such a terrible person. It makes no sense. And I feel the same way that I could feel the tension between Sam Taylor Johnson and E.L. James in this movie. Like, you could, I agree with Haley, you could almost feel that Sam Taylor Johnson was trying to address some of these issues, because Dakota Johnson's performance as Anna is actually really strong, and I thought she did a really good job on it. And there are portions of it where, you know, Anna is acknowledging, she knows this is messed up, and she is acknowledging, she was like, hold on, like, this isn't right, and kind of standing up for herself. Which was,
I will not immediately sign this sex contract.
She never signs it.
The crux of the film.
No, she never signs it.
I know. I'm just saying, like, but that's the crux of the movie.
Yeah.
Like, it goes on. Like, that's actually the entire thing where the film turns, is the intricacies of the fuck contract, where the term butt plug escapes the understanding of an English major.
Sure.
Yeah.
What is
well,
it? Sure. I'm not
do
sure
what?
I said, what is a dishwasher? I don't feel like it's descriptive. Like, that pretty much says it all.
Yeah, the characters are stupid. But it was just it was just upsetting from an emotional standpoint, that it was just and also offensive as a, you know, like, here, I'll buy you a car. here, come ride in my helicopter. Like, material things are incentives to sign my contract. Like, that's offensive. Like, there were portions of this movie where my girlfriend was literally kicking the seat because she was like, nope, not cool. Like, nope. When he, like, grabs her and he's like, you're mine. She's like, that's not, nope. So I just don't understand. Like, that's, and that's honestly interesting. Like, that is, that is something worth exploring.
Yeah, if you have the emotional if you have the emotional maturity to handle that, I'm not against seeing that film, that story on screen, but you have to have the understanding of how to handle it.
Yeah.
And 50 Shades of Grey is nowhere close.
Well, and I think the, again, I think the issue is that, I mean, we've all heard the stories that Sam Taylor Johnson and the author had huge fights on set. The problem with this is that E.L. James was given unprecedented creative control on this movie. She shopped it with producers to studios. It wasn't like a studio bought the rights and then said, you know, you can come to set every now and then. She
to say hi and show up at, you know, the premiere.
Yeah, she had studios literally pitching themselves to her, saying, let us produce your movie. So she wielded an insane amount of creative control. And if you've read 50 Shades of Grey, it is, you will see that she is no J.K. Rowling or, you know, someone who has very much artistic acumen. So yeah, I just felt like it was just frustrating because there were glimmers of stuff that were kind of okay. And again, I think Dakota Johnson is incredible in this movie, given what, you know, the material that she's given. She's
the
only
co-star she's given.
Yeah, well, and I don't even think that's Jamie Dornan's fault.
I will lay this at his feet because I think Christian Grey has the potential to be an interesting character insofar as, again, if you have the mature, if you want to address the film in this particular way, if Sam Taylor Johnson is looking at the film through a certain prism, and I think Dakota Johnson was kind of on that wavelength, then you have Jamie Dornan who's just like blankly reciting lines. Like, I look at Christian Grey and I see a character who could be dangerous and threatening and that the film wants, you know, I should feel uneasy about this character. But really what this film is due in part to his performance is that it's implying the insidious message that abusive people just need a hug.
Yeah.
It's, oh, he had a hard life. Don't, you know, he's coding it because it's all coded in this, like, sick sheen of romance, and no one's really challenging what is happening. The text is not being challenged enough. And so Jamie Dornan is playing into this sort of, you know, weird fantasy that should not exist by virtue of just basically being handsome and nothing else.
I think he's first and foremost focused on trying to nail down his American accent, which is terrible and which is distracting. And knowing that Charlie Hunnam was the first choice of this, I was like, that's not any better.
That's maybe worse.
And I think that's honestly that it creates like a block, whereas like he does it, it's stilted. All of his dialogue sounds stilted because his American accent is really bad. And nothing sounds genuine coming from him.
And it's not like this was great dialogue to begin with.
No.
But I actually wanted to talk about that because I would wager hard money that Charlie Hunnam and Dakota Johnson had really wonderful chemistry when they cast the film, and that would have carried a lot of it. And I mean, we've seen on Sons of Anarchy that he can do dangerous but charming, like somebody who's obviously a bad guy but draws you in. And just Jamie Dornan didn't do that at all, which was confusing to me because he's like a really good actor on The Fall. But he just what Matt was saying, he just sort of rode this like everything I do is okay because I'm gorgeous. And even when he's outlining, you know, she goes, why would I do this? And he goes, you get me. Like, no.
Well, what's also really weird, is, you know, if Johnson and Hunnam had chemistry, why throw that out? Because clearly Johnson and Dornan have no chemistry, and they clearly just flat out dislike each other. If you want to see a fun video, look up their press tour and a Q&A they did for Glamour, and oh my god, you could cut the hatred with a knife. It is so thick between them.
And it reads that way in the movie. I mean, not on her side, like Adam said, and just all the credit to her. She's wonderful, and it makes me so upset how much hate she's gotten and how mean people are. By the way, she's also fucking gorgeous. Like, yeah. All the people who say how ugly she is, and no, she's beautiful.
I fell in love with her when she had, like, 2 minutes of screen time in The Social Network. Like, she just exudes this... She has a thing about her. This charisma, this just, like, naturalness that makes it someone relatable.
Yeah, I'm hoping that the good... If one good thing comes out of 50 Shades of Grey, it's a good career for Dakota Johnson. And I think that's possible, because all the reviews have been pointing out, even the negative ones, that she's really good.
I will say... if we're going to focus on the positive for a second, if there's something good that's come out of this, it seems to have allowed a lot of people who wouldn't otherwise have a moment to discuss their sexuality a little more openly. And that's cool. That's like an unexpected positive side effect. I don't know if that'll outweigh the amount of fantasizing about completely damaging, emotionally abusive relationships, but it's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, and another thing that was troubling to me, I mean, and we learned beforehand that Jamie Dornan had signed a no penis contract. Basically, like, he wasn't going full frontal, Dakota Johnson would be. But he's in his...
I'm sorry.
It's a no penis
contract. I woke up this morning and didn't expect to hear the term no penis contract.
but
go on.
It seems to me... you know, in all these scenes, she's naked a lot in this movie, and he's always got his jeans on. And to me, that, and I could be reading it wrong, but to me, it just kind of reinforced this objectification aspect of it, of kind of like, you are my plaything, and I will dress as I please.
Also, how good did he have to be like to for him to be offered that contract? Like, what? How good was his screen test? Because this is like not like, oh man, no one wants this role. It's like it's a big role.
No, nobody wanted it because of
no one
nudity.
Wanted this role.
The nudity was the issue, and a lot of people were scared of it. They had a really hard time casting this movie. That's why they had to push the release date back after Hunnam dropped out.
That's actually now to me that raises some interesting questions.
Look at that.
About male actors who apparently, I guess it's like, you know, if you're not doing it, if there's not a potential Oscar involved, you're not going to show your junk. Or, you know, if it's not a comedy.
Yeah.
Intentional comedy.
If you're not Jason Segel.
If you're not Jason Segel. yeah, that's, I'm sorry, go on.
I just wanted to point out one more thing that really upset me. Was harkening back to the emotional abuse a little bit when they're discussing the contract. Oh, which, by the way, I think the only part of the movie that almost came close to being the sort of enjoyable cheese fest I had hoped for was the actual negotiation scene in the business room. That was all right.
That scene's great.
But the part where he says, I'll throw in a sweetener for you, and says, once a week they can go on a date.
Yeah.
Like, you give up your whole life for me and once a week I'll treat you nice. And like, that's like textbook. It's terrible. It's a guide to how to emotionally manipulate your girlfriend. Like, it's just so upsetting.
Yeah, and it's play. And see, the thing is, the film just doesn't seem, I just never feel like Taylor Johnson is pushing back on this. That's the thing, like with the sex scenes, I'm watching these sex scenes and they're all played as seductive. Like, there's nothing, and I'm not saying like she necessarily had to go overbearing with it, but there's nothing left of center here. There's nothing, like, she's never looking askance at this situation. It very much played like a soft romance, and I'm not saying like you need to spell things out, but at the same time, it is unquestioning towards a very questionable relationship.
Yeah, I imagine E.L. James and the producers were very heavily involved in those sex scenes.
Yeah, and I don't want to like lay the blame at Taylor Johnson, but at the same time, I kind of, you know, she's the director. I can't.
Yeah.
You know, say, and then E.L. James came in here and said to do, you know, to use this music and this lighting and this, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Can I just? Sorry, go ahead.
No. Please, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, have you guys heard of this documentary, Kink? It just came out. It's about it's a documentary about kink.com, the porn website. And it is so extreme and intense. and it goes much, not as deep as one would hope, into the exploration of like why people choose this sexual lifestyle, but it gets pretty real with like how intense it can be. And just, I watched that sort of in preparation for watching 50 Shades of Grey, and the contrast between what's in that documentary and how tame and timid everything is in the movie, it's not even beginning to skim the surface of the interesting dynamics of power play. It's not going there at all.
No, well, and I haven't seen this documentary, so let me ask you this. In the documentary, is the behavior depicted as unhealthy? Because 50 Shades of Grey, I think, is very judgmental, basically saying anyone who did this would have to be the victim of what is essentially statutory rape. You know, anyone who does this, anything that this is clearly outside the bounds of what we of healthy sexual behavior. And I'm talking about the actual sex acts of the BDSM, not the whole, like, I'll be nice to you for a day.
Right.
I'm talking about the actual sex acts, and the film, I think, paints them as, like, anyone who would, you know, wear a blindfold during sex, that's terrible. You must have a deeply damaged childhood. And I don't know if that's right. What the documentary is saying.
No, it's not. It's not at all. It's actually pretty fair representation of the fact that it's complicated and weird, and it's actually a pretty fair representation of the sex industry, which isn't something that gets a lot of fair treatment. I would recommend it. It's interesting, but I would recommend it with the warning that it is hardcore, and at points you are basically watching kink.com porn. Like, you have to be for that, otherwise you're probably gonna freak out.
Fair warning.
Yeah, but it is. It does. They interview the directors of these pornography films and ask them why they are into that, and they, you know, they go into when the fantasies came about and why and how they're translating that now in a healthy way, as opposed to locking someone into a sex slave contract and treating them like shit. So yeah, I approve of the documentary thing.
Yeah, and so I'm again, that's just, I feel like another way, like, I feel like I'm not watching 50 Shades of Grey, I feel like I'm not against the idea of 50 Shades of Grey, in the sense of I would be interested to watch a complex relationship drama about a abusive relationship that is depicted with a knowingly, not preachy, but mature approach to both to power dynamics and kinky sexual behavior. That sounds interesting to me. And 50 Shades of Grey is just completely blows it, and just, it's so obtuse. It's somewhat remarkable. And then I found out where the books go, and we are in for a painful two more movies, probably three more movies.
Well,
we know how this game is played now.
Well,
people,
what's upsetting about that is now, you know, Taylor Johnson's out. Like, all of the things we've read now is, you know, she's not coming back. But I mean, and not from her own choice.
Right.
And seeing how little she was able to kind of push the needle away from James's source material and start to kind of dig into other things. I mean, no other respecting director is going to sign on to this movie now, knowing how much power the author wields on the project. So they're just going to get a yes man or a yes woman, and it's going to be even more offensive.
Yeah, see, that's the good thing about Hollywood, is that you actually are no shortage of
people
with no self-respect.
Well, even down to, did you read the ending that Sam Taylor Johnson wanted for the film? Was Dakota Johnson's character saying red, and E.L. James was like, no, she has to say stop.
Yeah.
Even just that tiny word change makes a difference thematically and overall. It's just kind of a fuck you to him if she were saying red, and that was the thing that made him stop and made him realize, oh shit, I fucked up.
Right, invoking the safe word when that's
yeah.
all he understands.
Yeah, and it's just so... E.L. James just has no understanding of, like, no, it's gotta be stop. That's stronger. just doesn't.
Yeah,
it's just maybe it's so frustrating.
Yeah. Well, maybe what she should do is she should watch the Twilight movies and then she should direct herself.
My girlfriend leaned over to me during a point towards the beginning of the movie and she goes, "That's literally a line from Twilight." Where he says something about, like, "I can't stop thinking about you," or "I can't." Something about himself and how he's.
Something about obsessive behavior.
Yeah, something
and
about
how that's supposed to be romantic.
Obsessive creep stalker.
And how that's true love.
And I liked how the friend Jose is Jacob. She couldn't even bother to change the first letter of his name.
It's all very obvious.
Yeah.
But, I mean, even. This is just sad to even say, but the whole time I was sort of like, yeah, I'd rather be watching Twilight.
Yeah. At least.
Yeah, how did we get there?
How did we get here?
Yeah.
I don't know. I could have a competition between, like, which film is more damaging in terms of depicting healthy relationships than 50 Shades of Grey or New Moon. Actually, here's the thing. Why Twilight, I think, was. I still actually have to say 50 Shades of Grey, I find less offensive than Twilight, because 50 Shades of Grey is not directed at tween girls. And if you're reading 50 Shades of Grey, at least at least it's an R-rated film. You're not going in there, it's like, huh, so that's how relationships should work. Because if you're fucking 12 and you watch New Moon and you think, oh, you definitely should kill yourself if your boyfriend moves away, like, that's bad. That's a very bad place to be. So I still got to give the edge to Twilight for things that make me vomit.
Fair enough.
You can see 50 Shades of Grey starting at the age of 12 in France. So.
Well, yeah. Other than that, France is knockout.
Their
rating
is
12
plus.
Did you see the last week tonight?
Yeah.
With the little kid smoking a cigarette. Yeah. France. But yeah, for 50 Shades of Grey, this is awful. I'm not looking forward to more of these movies.
Nor are Dakota Johnson and Jamie Dornan. Nor anyone involved in these movies. Like, it seems like everyone is just unhappy with the result.
Including the fans.
Yeah, including the fans, including the author, including the producers. Dana Brunetti is, like, buddy-buddy with E.L. James, and it just seems like this was it was a huge deal when they were shopping it. I don't know if you remember, like, this was big, like, that
it sold 100 million copies.
Yeah, that they were going
to make a fuck ton of books.
And they spent so much time finding the right director and the right screenwriter, and now it's just, they're all just upset.
Now it's the Bataan death march of franchises.
Yeah, no one's happy.
Because it made too much money to quit. Like, the drop-off is going to be severe, but it doesn't matter, because it's still going to make more money on its second weekend than Hot Tub Time Machine 2.
I
know anybody who's coming at this as a fan, and I haven't really connected on, like, the internet. Have you guys paid attention to how the fans of the books have reacted? Are they not thrilled? It's been something I've been meaning to look into.
I think that they were actually, they sort of, I actually need to look at that as well. I do know that they were unhappy from the word casting.
Right.
they had their
hashtag not my Christian.
Hashtag not my Christian. And that's like, and I understand fans, like, have a very flocked in idea, and sometimes an actor has to disrupt that, you know? But as far as this movie goes, I don't know. I would be very curious to find out how those fans believe that the film was represented, because, again, looking at those quotes I just read, the book that they fell in love with is deeply fucked up, and I definitely don't want to see that on the screen.
Okay, here's the thing, though, that I'll say for that. It is. It's deeply fucked up. But reading it, it didn't, to me, translate as, despite the quotes that you read, which were horrifying, as abusive, because in your head you can picture all sorts of wild chemistry between them, and that can, you know, make up for all manner of sins. But when you see it on the screen with just Dornan as the dead fish demanding sex, it's all the more disturbing. To me, that's how it was for me. Reading it, I was like, well, that was shitty, and that's clearly not a good relationship. But, he said some hot things, they did some hot stuff. In the movie, it was like, no, nothing is hot, nothing is fun at all. Everything is just very upsetting and very abusive.
Right, because you can't sort of shoehorn this into romance. And I will make it, I do also want to say that I didn't go into 50 Shades of Grey expecting it to be nymphomaniac. Like, I knew that they wouldn't go super hardcore, and I'm fine, with what was depicted, and I'm fine with that. I just felt like the lack of emotional maturity put this film in a realm where it doesn't please anybody. Again, like, it didn't please the people who made it, the people who starred in it, the person who wrote it. It doesn't appease people who aren't fans. There were people, like, I know that there were people gearing up for 50 Shades of Grey. It's like, oh, this is going to be a campy good time.
Yeah,
ah, ha, ha. And it's not. It's just a boring movie. It doesn't have the courtesy to even reach you.
Yeah, it's boring. That's the biggest sin that it, well, I don't know. The emotionally abusive relationship is pretty upsetting. But it is, the fact that it's boring is not great.
And it just does. There was really only that one brief scene where they negotiate. That was the only time in the movie that I was like, "Oh, this is fun. Oh, it's over."
Yeah. There were some times where she would shoot back at him, where I was kind of like, "Oh, that's kind of nice." But then it, you know, again, it just doesn't really go anywhere. She just keeps kind of walking around the issue of the contract.
And I appreciate the ending, but we all know that's going to be undermined by 2 to 3 more films.
Yeah.
The audience, here's something though. Haley, let me ask you this. Does the book end the same way as the movie?
Oh, good God. I can't even remember. It was like 2 years ago. No, I can't remember. I know it ends, like, they definitely have that falling out, but I can't remember if they make up before the start of the second book.
See, I think they might. I mean, I don't know. I was in a room full of fans of the book, and the movie ends, like, it's like, goodbye, Anna, goodbye, Christian, and the doors close, and the movie ends, and they were like, what? They were pissed.
According to Wikipedia, it just says, devastated, Anna leaves Christian and returns to the apartment she shares with Kate. And that's the end.
Huh.
So
they were still not pleased.
Well, it was just probably because you don't really expect a movie to end that way. You expect an episode of TV to end that way, but movies usually have, you know, 5 to 10 minutes of denouement, whereas this one didn't. Or thankfully, because I kept looking at my watch, it was like 45 more minutes.
Thankfully, this movie is over 2 hours for some fucking reason.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's horrifying and not okay.
I needed to know what his parents are like for some.
Oh, talk about how rude he is to his mother. Like,
yeah.
That's a
Marcia Gay Harden.
She comes all the way over to see him, and he's like, oh, you gotta go. And she's like, oh, well, all right, sweetie, bye. Like, you were here for 2 minutes. Like, well, what a waste of time.
And, Anastasia gets a phone call, and she's like, I'm so sorry. And he's like, don't worry about it. I was just showing her out.
I almost, wanted him to say, mother, you know how busy I am being a businessman. I am an important businessman, and I do business for a living.
Also,
and it has made me very rich from business.
You know something that's not okay is to take out your stress of a bad day at work by beating your girlfriend. Like, that was just, she came in, and he was so stressed, and he was like, let's go to the red room now. I need to work out some of this stress with my belt.
It's all bad. It's real bad.
And clearly, with as ripped as he is, he clearly must have a gym. Work out some aggression at the gym. Look at those washboards. It's just defense. Oh, gosh, yeah. There's just so many bad things about this film, and we're in for 2 more, or 3 more. They'll split the last one. I don't care. That's just how we do things.
Can they split a romantic drama in two? Like, can they really stretch that? I don't know. I haven't read the books. Does anybody know what happens? Because I've heard it's just a whole bunch of nothing.
Yeah, it's nothing. I stopped after the first one because
you value your time.
Yeah, and but I did read the synopses, and nothing happens. Just a lot of almost titillating sex scenes and some stalker drama, and the character they slightly referred to yet another abusive moment, Mrs. Robinson. Where she's like, you shouldn't talk to her, she is a child molester, and he's like, I do what I want, I don't care what you think.
He's Cartman. He becomes Cartman.
I do what I want.
Exactly. But he has no regard for her opinions or thoughts or feelings, clearly. And so she plays a part, but all of it boils down to, he can be saved and he can love me, and he beats me because he loves me.
And then they have a child, get married and have a child together. Yep.
Spoiler alert.
Sorry. That's the ending of the series, guys. Whoops.
That's how Hannibal Lecter was born.
It's Twilight. It's Twilight. I mean, that is the end of Twilight, so I guess we
Yeah, well,
surprised.
Excuse me, sir. I will say, if the last 50 Shades of Grey movie has a gigantic werewolf vampire battle, I will be forgiven.
Beheadings. Just a whole lot of beheadings.
Just tons of beheadings. If someone takes Janie Dornan by the roof of his mouth and rips his head off, then, and only then, will I retract some of my statements.
That'd be great if they got Bill Condon to direct the next two. Or it's just like they're not even hiding the fact that it's Twilight, basically.
They just lock E.L. James in a phone booth somewhere and just leave her.
Well, I read that she was like really obsessed with getting Robert Pattinson to sign on as Christian Grey. Like, she wasn't even trying to hide that. She just wanted
ridiculous.
That. It's really obvious.
Why would he want to do that?
Good God.
This has all been a part of her elaborate plan just to meet Robert Pattinson.
Basically.
Like she's made millions of dollars, and she doesn't even care. She just wants to meet Pattinson. Like, that's her goal in life.
And judging by how fond he is of Twilight, I'm sure he's a big fan of hers.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. All right. Well, I've hated on 50 Shades of Grey enough for one evening. Do any of y'all have anything more to say on it, or should we move on to recommendations?
Let's move on.
Let's talk about movies we like. Haley, what movie do you like that we should watch?
It has been my extreme pleasure and surprise that one of the movies that has arose out of the 50 Shades of Grey conversation has been Secretary, which is my recommendation. Do not watch the stupid ass new trailer they put together for this re-release. Just watch the movie. It is very strikingly similar to 50 Shades of Grey in setup. It's a very, you know, awkward young woman goes and meets a successful businessman and they engage in a BDSM relationship. But everywhere that 50 Shades of Grey turns left and does the offensive, dumb thing, Secretary turns right and does the engaging, interesting thing. The characters are allowed to be damaged. They explore their damage together. And most importantly, the submissive is not subject to any sort of torture. She is partaking of it as her own personal growth, and they grow together, and it's a beautiful love story, and I highly recommend and love this movie.
All right. Definitely second that recommendation. Easily one of Maggie Gyllenhaal's best performances, for sure.
Yeah.
That was kind of like a breakthrough role for her, too.
Absolutely.
For sure. Okay, Secretary. Adam, what about you?
I am recommending something where Jamie Dornan is not a, you know, charismaticless blah. and it is a TV show called The Fall, which is a BBC One production, but it also airs exclusively on Netflix here in the United States. And it is about a serial killer, but not really. From episode one, you know who the serial killer is. It is a man played by Jamie Dornan, a man with a family. And Gillian Anderson of X-Files fame plays a London senior police officer who's investigating a string of murders in Belfast, Northern Ireland. And I would describe this more as a psychological thriller. It's not a procedural. It's not a whodunit. And what's so great about this show is that it's, I would say its main thematic focus is on gender roles and misogyny. And because Jamie Dornan's character is a man who strangles women, strangles and kills women. And Gillian Anderson plays this woman in a high-ranking job, and it kind of delves into how she navigates that job, but not from a place of, like, I'm struggling to get to the top, or I'm over, you know, I'm trying to overcome struggles. More of a, you know, I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and if you don't like it, you can fuck off. And it's really fascinating because it kind of delves into this psyche of, you know, we see so many serial killers on TV and on procedurals. It's, I mean, every show is about a white guy killing white girls or someone killing white girls. And this actually delves into the psychology of it. And it's funny because Jamie Dornan's serial murderer on The Fall, who's a misogynist who kills women, is almost more likable than Christian Grey.
By far.
And he really is. But Gillian Anderson is fantastic on the show. It's a bit of a slow burn, but it's really, really enthralling and really interesting, and really strongly feminist. Something that just doesn't really get much attention on TV. It's usually, you know, like, oh, there's the strong woman playing whatever, but it actually delves into the issues surrounding that. And I think Gillian Anderson is fantastic in the show. So is Jamie Dornan. The first season is 5 episodes, each an hour each. Second season is 6 episodes, each an hour each. Both seasons are now on Netflix. Season 2 just went up recently, I think. And they're both fantastic. Well worth your time. Something that is both entertaining and thought-provoking. So The Fall on Netflix.
Awesome. When you emailed me what your recommendation was, I'm like, why are you recommending some fucking Lee Pace movie?
the right. Tarsem Singh movie?
I'm like, all right, dude, if that's what you want to recommend, all right.
I haven't seen that, but I've seen The Cell. I could have recommended The Cell. That's another keeping women under lock and key movie.
Yeah, but I'm more interested in The Fall, so I'm going to watch that now. Because I had heard about it, but I didn't know what it was, so I'll definitely... check that out.
Fantastic, and I very much recommend it very strongly as a second recommendation. And I just want to say that Gillian Anderson's character, Stella Gibson, is like, if there was an antidote to the virus that is 50 Shades of Grey, she would be it.
Oh, she's great. She's just unabashedly feminist, but not in a, like, I'm going to show you way. She's just kind of like... It's not preachy. It's just kind of, she just exudes feminism in a way that's like, why isn't, like, this should be the norm? Like, why is this not normal?
And so unabashed about her own sexuality and what she wants. So.
Oh, yeah. It's very sexually open, the show is. In a way, again, that's not emotionally abusive. So.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to have to watch this fucking fairy tale you're talking about. I don't think this show exists, but okay. Well, my recommendation is Matthew Vaughn's 2007 film Stardust. Matthew Vaughn's a little bit of a difficult to pin down, I think in part because of Stardust. Because Kingsman and Kick-Ass are both from Mark Miller. X-Men First Class is, you know, from a comic book. His debut is Layer Cake, which is a crime film. And they're all very good, but Stardust is a fantasy movie, unabashedly fantasy. It's about a guy in a handsome young man in a village who sees a shooting star fall to Earth, but the shooting star is actually a beautiful young woman who's played by Claire Danes, and he goes to retrieve the star and bring her back to the girl he hopes to woo, who's played by Sienna Miller. Who, if in 1 week, is planning to marry this other fellow, who, in a blink and you'll miss it role, is Henry Cavill. So that was surprising, and so
he's got a little bit more of a blink and you miss it. He's a little
The film. Like, I mean, he comes. I mean, it's something. He doesn't look like Henry. He's around.
You'll miss it.
But he does not look like Henry Cavill. I was like, is that fucking Henry Cavill? And that's what I mean. It's like, is that fucking Cavill? And it is.
It's fucking Cavill.
It's fucking Cavill. Daredevil and Superman are sharing the screen because Charlie Cox plays the young man.
Nerd, you're a fucking nerd.
We'll talk about that movie later. So he's going to get the star, but then there are these princes who hope to take their father's throne, but in order to take the throne, they need the star. And so it's sort of, she's like this MacGuffin. And I remembered Stardust fondly, but then I decided to go back and rewatch it. And on a rewatch, I admit that it definitely has some flaws, such as, I think, Claire Danes is miscast. Claire Danes does not come off as a magical person. You know, she comes off as gritty and real, which is why she was so effective in My So-Called Life and Homeland. I think that the film is a little too long, but at the same time, like, I really like how it squeezes in a lot of dark comedy. And I think that's where Matthew Vaughn sort of shows his hand in terms of he's good at, like, not just a visual style and really soaking into a genre, but sort of finding ways to go into it that he finds certain aspects of it and then takes it to a comically dark place. So, for example, Michelle Pfeiffer plays a witch who is after the star, because if she gets it, if she cuts out the heart of the star, she can eat it and become young. So her and her sisters, they're trying to find it. How do they find it? They read entrails. So this is where Matthew Vaughn will take an animal out of a cage and chop it up and have them dig through the animal's guts. Like, oh, okay, well, that just happened. And it's PG-13. They don't really, like, go into, like, the darkness of it. But, you know, they make fun of, you know, this is how witches would be. It's not just, you know, very soft and pleasant around the edges. He's aware of these sort of moments where he can make things a little twisted and weird as well. You see the ghosts of the brothers who have died trying to get their father's thrones, because the brothers are always trying to kill each other. Mark Strong plays one of the brothers. He is great. Robert De Niro has a great supporting role that really is surprising and funny, and it's unique in his recent filmography because it looks like he's having fun. So that's a standout.
Or at least gives a shit.
Yeah, gives a shit, having fun. Looks like he wants to be there.
So, like the SNL 40. I don't know if you saw him on Saturday Night Live 40th anniversary.
Did he not look like he wanted to be there?
I think he wanted to be there, but he was just so poorly reading off cue cards. It was just uncomfortable.
Yeah. Well, he's good in Stardust. Stardust is a film where I'm like, I'm not going to, like, raise it up to say, like, it will change your mind about fantasy. But I think if you want to get a better idea of who Vaughn is as a director, I think Stardust is definitely worth checking out. It's very entertaining. It's an entertaining film. It's light. I think it's definitely something where if you have a couple hours, it's on Netflix. Watch Stardust.
It's so, like, have a Neil Gaiman story, right? Everybody likes Neil Gaiman.
Yes, we all like Neil Gaiman.
Exactly.
I know. I like Neil Gaiman. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you should follow us on Twitter. Haley, what is your Twitter handle?
I'm at Haley Fouch.
Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Adam Chitwood.
All right. And you can find me at Matt Goldberg. Thanks for listening, everyone. And we will be back with you next week.